Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, it's time for another Rebooting the News with me and Jay Rosen. Jay?
Hi Dave, and
hi, Jay.
Hello listeners.
So here we are, another Monday morning. It's a morning podcast now.
Rebooting the News number 17.
17, my God, how did we get this deep into it?
We have to fight our way out, like, you know, a gang in hostile territory gets to fight their way into the city and back home.
Well, I think we're just going deeper and deeper.
We have to lead off with TechCrunch, this week's big story in the tech and journalism beat, but I want you to summarize what happened and then we can sort it out.
Well, that's part of the problem is we don't know what happened. And so this goes to another thing that came out this week, which was a restatement by David Weinberger of his transparency is the new impartiality? Is that what
objectivity.
It is? Objectivity, right. And that got a big thumbs up from Mike Arrington at TechCrunch, who is the top guy there. And I thought, wow, this is odd because they are so not transparent. We don't know what happened. What we do know is that he announced that he had 310 documents that belonged to Twitter, Inc. And he described those documents as being, meeting notes and financial projections and passwords to email accounts and social security numbers, I think, and credit card accounts and food preferences, all kinds of stuff. And so he sort of put it into two categories, the stuff that he felt he should report on and other stuff he wasn't going to report on. And in the process, there was this long quiet period after he announced that he had all this stuff that we heard nothing. And supposedly what was going on was a negotiation between TechCrunch and the company. But I found that really puzzling because what negotiating leverage would the company possibly have here? I mean, how kind of a negotiation would this be?
Right.
And you characterized it as negotiating with a person who's robbing your house or something?
The fence. It's like having a discussion with the fence about the things that were stolen from your living room.
Right. It's
what's
a kind of awkward conversation.
Yeah, it would be awkward. Now, we have the goods, right?
It would be hard to avoid slamming the phone down in anger, which I think we did actually see Evan Williams do at one point. And then there's also the possibility, just mention this, and then I'll turn it over to you, that this is all just an act, that it's all, sock puppets. And, Mike Arrington's pretending to do something to piss them off. He has some data. And there was a disclosure, by the way, and the disclosure was very valuable for a guy like me, who wants to really understand how they're thinking inside that company. There's no question it was valuable. But how much of it was real? How much of it was play acting? Because guess what? The suggested user list is part of this too, because TechCrunch is on it and has almost 1 million followers now. And the vast majority of those followers came from being on the suggested user list. So there's a relationship between Twitter and TechCrunch, and it is anything but transparent.
Mm. Well, in your summary, you left out the fact that according to TechCrunch's account of the episode, the documents came by way of a basically invasion of private email through a hacker who used Google's password protection system and secret question system to bust into someone's email in Twitter, right?
Yes, I did see that out. It wasn't intentional, by the way.
Right. So that's part of what happened. And so immediately, everybody who follows technology, follows journalism, follows investigative reporting, is kind of drawn into a story like this because it raises so many questions, And I don't myself have an easy view of it. I think my main opinion about it is that it's actually a very tough case, like you have in the law. Tough cases make bad law. It's sometimes said in the law. Mm-hmm. I don't know about that part, but I know it's a tough case, and it's a difficult call because there's nothing illegal about it if it happened the way it was said, even though there's something very dubious about the method. And
well, somebody committed a crime in there.
Right.
There probably is a crime here, but what you're saying is that TechCrunch didn't do anything illegal.
I doubt it.
Neither of us are lawyers, so we're not
right.
On that, right?
It doesn't seem from what we know that there's anything illegal in it, and that makes publishing a editorial call and a judgment call.
And you think that it was a mistake, right? We differ on this, by the way. I think they made the right call at TechCrunch.
Right.
Assuming the facts are as they've said them, which we don't have any way of verifying. Assuming that it's true, I think they did the right thing.
Right.
You don't think they did.
No, I don't necessarily. What I said was, because this is as far as I could get, is I don't support what they did.
Okay. Right. You didn't say it was wrong. You said you don't support it.
Right. I don't support, which I often do support people who publish things that are controversial. You know, like I like to do that. That's my main pose.
But I don't get it. Why don't you support this? I mean, is it because you're not interested in the data that came out?
No. As a reader, I had the same level of interest as anybody else. I found it fascinating. I read it. And of course, it's now part of the record because of what happened. But I think the part that, as I tried to say on Twitter, is that even though it's confusion because we don't know exactly how it happened and there's difficult calls and you can argue the cases different ways, there's something about it that bothered me where a leak of information you have access to because you're part of the story, to me, starts in a different place than breaking and entering in somebody's email and then leaking what you got.
You see,
I really think that is a good description for it, even though I don't know if it meets any illegal test. Let's say, conceit, all right, breaking and entering, which is what I think it was, is fine for describing the difference in moral terms between leaking what happened in this case. And I feel that if you build that kind of lapse into the chain of reasoning for your story, it's not going to build a strong story. And so I don't know that you can proceed and build trust that way. So that's why I said I couldn't support what they did. But possibly the execution of it, you know, could matter. So for example, to go back to one of your observations, if we at least knew everything TechCrunch had, right,
mm-hmm.
with a description, and then we could look at what they had published and let us know about, right,
mm-hmm.
then
yeah.
we knew what the reason was why they withheld it, right, then that's a little bit different. And so that might affect one's judgment.
And if there hadn't been that gap in time, you had to wonder, what are they doing? Why
well, yeah.
is it so long, you know? And you got to wonder what's going on. Are they trying to negotiate some kind of deal with Twitter? Are they blackmailing Twitter? I mean, that's the question that sort of crossed my mind. It's like, okay, what are they getting in return for not releasing some information, some part of this?
Yeah, I have no idea. But I did find that just the narrative arc, the logic of it, that they're negotiating, they're talking with Twitter about what should be published. It just
right.
seemed strange to me. It hit a note of weirdness.
Jay, that isn't the argument that most critics used, okay? It was more
what
like...
What did they say?
It's like, I know it when I see it, that kind of thing. There's a lot of hand-waving involved, saying, well, this is wrong. And
right, that's because I decide these things different than they do.
I understand.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that you're responsible for how they did it. It's like
no,
Paris
right.
Wisher, for example.
No, I know. I know
predictably,
exactly.
Will predictably call TechCrunch out and say that they're wrong on stuff, which is nice. It's useful to have somebody like that around because you can always get the negative.
What was her reasoning?
Just that. It's like, I know it when I see it.
This
is wrong. Right. And when I get a memo leaked from somebody inside Yahoo that has Carol Barth, who's the CEO, verbatim at her management meeting while it's going on, I mean, live tweeted, you know, direct to Kara, that's not wrong. But, and, you know, the the hacker here actually had a relationship with Twitter. He was apparently angry with them. He was angry because they had characterized a previous break-in of his and minimized it when he had actually accomplished something that he hadn't accomplished. It's convoluted. I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for that guy, right? I mean, you know, but there are so many players. I think after the fact, I found it much less interesting to discuss the morality of this because what was revealed was so much more valuable. I mean, really, there was enough verbatim in their report that came out of this that you really got a very clear picture.
Okay, so what do we know about Twitter now after than we didn't know before? Tell us.
Characterize it. Well, there's no breaking news, okay? I mean, all the things, all the factual elements of it were pretty much visible before. There was no major news. But they put words to attitudes that you could see. They're very not impressed with the users of their service. And they're not willing to go very far out of their way for them. And they have sort of this goes back, in my experience, you know, I was first a user in the online world of CompuServe in the early 1980s. And my brother worked at CompuServe at the time. He was worked in Columbus, Ohio. So I had a channel. I was both a user of the system, and I was a user before he was an employee. And it was a community not very much unlike Twitter. I mean, it was quite similar. And they called the users the Lonely Hearts Club. And this is how they built this wall for themselves, why they were superior to the people who used the system. You see the same attitude inside Twitter, that these are the gods, these are the people, our superiors, and we are in their control. The other thing we learned is they plan to grow this closed system up to 1 billion users. I mean, that is outrageous. That is totally outrageous. It's never happened. I believe it can't happen. We have to get back to open systems at some point. You know, this is a walled garden. We are controlled. It's wholly clear how controlled we are from reading the notes from their meetings. They're doing everything they can to avoid letting other companies have access to their data. And our data. It's not really theirs. It's ours, you know. It's appalling, Jay. It's nothing less. It's nothing short of appalling. I just wish they would just give up the control issue here and see themselves as part of what's happening, not the source of what's happening, because they are not the source of what's happening.
All right. So the narrative payoff is big enough to overwhelm any moral qualms that might be, and it shouldn't even be stated.
Well, is that an issue? You know, Mr. Journalism Professor, you know, do the ends justify the means?
I don't know. I guess sometimes probably they do. That's why I don't think it's a case for sharp judgments.
So if there had been no value to it, if it had just been basically what kind of sandwiches they like, you know, then who cares, right? I mean, you can't do that. That's criminal. It's bad.
Well, I'll tell you what interests me, Dave, is the part is I'm trying to figure out, and this is one of these problems I have many where I feel like I'm about 15% of the way there. You know, if you imagine like a huge jigsaw puzzle or a huge wall-sized puzzle and you've got like 15% of it done.
Right.
So I'm about 15% of the way there trying to understand how is trust derived in an open system, in the system we have now? What is the best way of bidding for trust, of making it, of figuring out the practices that build trust or lead to it in the actual conditions you're doing journalism and news in now? This is one of my, as I said, struggles. So it's in that mode and in sort of inside the gears of that problem that I look at the TechCrunch thing and think we have to derive legitimacy of our reporting earlier in the process, you know, and that ultimately will pay off because you have to have enough trust and enough credibility to override the fact that lots of times people disagree with your reporting or it makes them angry or it alienates them. And this is one of the key problems is how do you get to that level of trust? So that's the context in which I wrestle with this, and that's all I wanted to to say by way of enclosure.
But I want to add something to this, okay, because there's something really fascinating. Because at first, listening to you, I wasn't sure who you were talking about when you said building trust, right? Because there's three players here, one of which we don't care about, which is the hacker. But the two are Twitter and TechCrunch.
Yeah.
And in the rebooted news system, both of them matter.
Yeah, sure.
In other words, because we're looking to Twitter to be a source going direct.
Right. Well, this is where your earlier remarks about the technology industry thinking it's the one to teach news are off. I agree with you in this respect. The journalists know way more about building trust than the tech industry does, editorially, so that people will listen to what you say. The tech industry, as far as I know, knows one thing, PR and hype.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And so there's a lot of learning to go on there. But it can only happen once we get away from, you know, war of archetypes and tribal warfare.
And the tech industry never seems to advance off the baseline of this. I mean, the first time I remember this exploding in the age of the Internet was when Intel had a chip. This was like 1996, I think it was. Intel had a chip, that a math chip, that would, under some circumstances, get the numbers wrong, okay? In other words, it would do a math operation and would come up with the wrong answer. And this, in turn, made Excel wrong in some places. And they chased the bug down to Intel's chip. And instead of fixing it or admitting that they had a problem, they just waved their hands. They said, well, chips do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they might have been right, but it was not what the users wanted to hear. And it ended up costing them billions of dollars.
Right.
Because to dig out of this, they had to, you know, recall all those chips. And what they didn't understand, and this was supposedly the last time a tech company needed to learn this lesson, which wasn't the way it worked out, that you need to be careful because now everybody's got a voice, right? You know?
Right. Different situation,
yeah. Okay.
And that's why I was so glad to see David Weinberger fashion his thoughts into a post actually called Transparency is the New Objectivity, because I really think this is a key principle of the rebooted system of news. And the more people who try and state it clearly for others, the better off we are.
Yep.
And we saw an example of it this week, Dave, with a little decision that the Washington Post made that I find huge and most people would think of as minor or perhaps merely gestural or symbolic, but not real, particularly real. And it was a decision by the new Washington Post editor, Marcus Brockley.
Who? What was the name?
Marcus Brockley is the Washington Post's editor now, replacing Len Downey, and has been for the last year or so. And he decided to make the ethics codes or ethics practices of the Washington Post essentially the handbook they have for reporters that tells them how the Washington Post does things, to make that public and make the rules that they develop for themselves public.
Mm.
The previous editors of the Post had always resisted that. And the ombudsman this week was writing about how to raise these standards and make them clearer to users, and mentioned that from now on, when they come up with their new code of practice, which they have to develop in part for the web, it'll be a public document. And Marcus Brockley, the editor of the Post, said, it'll be better. Readers will be able to hold us accountable to what we say we believe, right? Well, there it is. It's not the claim that we're the Washington Post, we don't have a stake, we're objective, we're apart from the struggling participants, right? Instead, it's here's the means for checking up on us. You can tell whether our claim to be this or that is, right? And he's acknowledging that that's a better way. Well, this is exactly what Weinberger is saying. And so it's the idea of transparency replaces objectivity is not that you have to show everything, or you know that there's some sort of totalizing ethic of disclosure involved. It's not. It's pragmatic. It's still solving problems. And so being open in that way is a more reliable way of building trust today than the wall, than the opacity of the church, of the priest, right? The majesty
mm-hmm.
of professional authority is, if asserted today in this climate, is actually a trust loser.
It's a trust loser to not show your, to not disclose.
Yeah.
Right?
To claim some sort of priestly authority.
I find it remarkable that they didn't used to.
I know. It's something they should have done a while ago. Meanwhile, over at the New York Times, something else happened that was very interesting.
I saw that. You're talking about the Hoyt thing. Right?
Yeah, just the fact that the newspaper realizes that it's going to want to be able to accept outside funding, nonprofit funding, possibly foundation funding, and the example that interests me, Spot Us, run by David Cohn in San Francisco, which is experimenting with basically crowdsourcing the funding of acts of journalism, had developed this idea for a story about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which is a floating pool of garbage out in the Pacific
mm-hmm.
that a mission is going to go and kind of investigate. And a reporter wants to go along, but there's a cost associated with it. So she kind of pitched the New York Times on the idea, and she pitched Spot Us on trying to fund it. And so the New York Times had to decide, was it willing to be public about its interest in a story funded by Spot Us, published in the New York Times? And they actually had to go through like a policy exercise to decide if this is something they want to do, or will it compromise, you know, their editorial mission. And they ended up interviewing David Cohen and thinking it through, and they decided they should be able to do this, and that it's not fundamentally different from the contact they have with freelance writers all the time. If you pitch the New York Times, they don't pay your expenses. And so the writer is free to generate her expenses her own way. So what it really is a pro-am system for funding the journalism of the New York Times. It's here.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little one case example so far, but already that method of doing it is alive.
But it's hypothetical, right? Nobody, I mean, it's
not
like,
hypothetical at all. The money is accumulating. And,
oh, it is? Okay,
yeah.
That was the question I was going to ask.
No, I haven't checked it lately, but I'd be surprised if it doesn't succeed in raising its goal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting, even though it's just one example.
So if this were to gain traction, right, then the system might work quite differently in the future. Basically, the Times would have a list of stories that they would do if they could get funding to do them, and the readers of the Times would have the option to, you know, obviously, to fund them, right?
Or it could be that there's an independent institution here that kind of puts these proposals up on the board. People fund them for different reasons, but the New York Times sometimes says, oh, yeah, we're interested in that one, and that helps it get funded, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily a system the Times runs. It could be a system the Times simply selects and participates in.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that it's a group of people outside the New York Times who are funding an act of journalism that runs in the New York Times. That is a different, rebooted system for financing news, right there.
Yeah, for sure.
So anyway, the things we talk about on this podcast, then they're approved to go out and happen. If you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. So
like they
exciting.
Get their wings, but of course a lot of them are happening without us anyway.
Uh-huh. Well, we're important, but I don't know that we're all that important. So, Jay, tell me what exit voice and loyalty means.
Oh, man. This is a fascinating trilogy of concepts that I wanted to test out on you because I think it's another one of these meeting points between tech and news.
Mm-hmm.
It's a concept developed by A.O. Hirschman, who's an economist in Princeton, who writes these very unusual books that are usually very short explanations of these key concepts that he's worked out over years and years and years of observing economic behavior. And one of them is called Exit, Voice, and Loyalty. And the thesis of this book is that when people are dissatisfied with a firm, when customers are dissatisfied with a firm, but it could also be within the industry, within an institution, with any structure in their lives, they have three fundamental choices, and he calls these exit, voice, and loyalty. Exit is facilitated especially by markets, and that's when we're dissatisfied with Chevys, and so we leave the market. We don't buy another Chevy. Mm-hmm. We just leave. We're no longer a customer.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because we're communicating, right? Your products no longer satisfy me.
Mm-hmm.
Second choice is voice. We might speak up and say, hey, Chevrolet, you promised that this warranty would work. You promised a better car. And you could talk to your dealer. You could talk to the company. You could try to write a letter, right? You, through whatever means available, you raise your voice and you tell about your dissatisfaction with the firm. Third choice available to rational people, Hirschman said, was loyalty, meaning, well, I could leave, but I don't want to, and I don't have much voice, but they have my loyalty. I'm attached to them somehow, or I feel I should. And, of course, loyalty is real, but it doesn't last forever, right? It can't survive indefinitely when people are dissatisfied with the firm. And what he then went on to do was ask a series of questions about why do people choose exit when they don't have a voice? And how is it that they become loyal? And what is that made of? And what can firms do when they find that they're suffering from this? And it just struck me as important because this is what the users of the new system faced. Right? Exit from their hometown newspaper. You know.
Right.
They could try to have voice, but it wasn't very easy. And there is a certain amount of loyalty, but it didn't last very long in the exploding arena of choice.
Well, they're not cultivating it. I mean, you know, we're pipsqueaks, remember? I mean, how when we have that kind of wall to overcome, how can you have a voice? I mean,
well, voice is fundamentally a political mechanism, and
mm-hmm.
this is exactly what challenged the news industry, is that it could not only couldn't reinvent itself, it couldn't reform itself politically, right? To allow for more voice, to allow for a shift in power, to change who's
right.
Who's the authority or sole authority in news. Those are all political challenges. In the broadest sense, they're challenges to the political imagination of the professionals in charge, if you know what I mean.
Right. But that's what they had to accommodate in order to make the transition.
Their only hope of preventing exit was to rely on the loyalty that was still there while they rapidly build voice.
Yeah, oh, that's very true. And is the conclusion, so what's the conclusion? Is there a conclusion from
the conclusion is that dissatisfaction with the news and with news providers was a clue to the future.
Right.
And it's still there to be addressed. And adding voice to the users should make the product more trusted if we can figure out what the right relationship is between listening to the users and telling them what they don't know. Right? And that, again, is not a religious struggle. It's not listen to the users or we're the church. It's how do you find that pragmatic combination that works and the practices that build trust if you pursue them over time. Not linking to other people who have a better account than yours does not build trust. It's not a practice that builds trust over time.
Well, it seems so far from ideal that, I mean, my concept of what's ideal in the news is that it should be a mirror, and the closer to perfect mirror it is, the better. It doesn't leave any room for the mirror doesn't have any godlike powers. It can just reflect back what's actually happening, you know.
Believe in objectivity.
No, not at all. If you let people speak for themselves, then you don't have any problems with, you don't have to be objective, you just have to reflect. You just have to, and you see, if you give voice to the people that are in your constituency, the understanding, that I think the point that's being, that got lost, I don't think being missed is the right way to say it, that got lost, is that what you're reporting on is the community that you're reporting to. You know, it's, in Berkeley, for example, when I wrote my inaugural piece for inberkeley.com, you know, as we were starting it, I felt it was necessary to write an essay that said, this is, you know, as we start this, this is what I'm thinking, so that I, you know, can look back in a few years and
say,
how crazy,
how naive,
you totally didn't understand Berkeley.
Absolutely.
Crazy. There are plenty of people around who will tell me that I don't understand Berkeley, and I admit I don't. I mean, I'm a newbie here, and I've remained out of the mess that Berkeley is. And so part of it, so I wrote one piece, one paragraph, basically, and it was critical of Berkeley, which said, I don't understand why the downtown of Berkeley is such a horror. You know, I mean, every other part of Berkeley has character, you know, has food, has, you know, community, has, you know, I mean, they may not all be like the kind of culture and community that I am rooted in, but that's not to say that they're not livable places. But downtown Berkeley is a horror. It's a mess. I hate it. And so do a lot of other people in Berkeley. I mean, I found that out. But the insiders in Berkeley, our Church of the Savvy here, doesn't want to hear it.
Uh-huh.
You're not entitled to an opinion about that. What do you know? You, and they have all these reasons to invalidate our point of view, you know. Oh, you're just a rich yuppie. What the hell do you know? You know, you're the enemy. You're the people we're trying to keep out of Berkeley. Okay, thanks so much. Well, but I'm here now. See, the point is that...
But you're saying you're going into
everywhere.
This project and you're going to try and mirror Berkeley?
Sure. Of course we're going to try to mirror Berkeley. That's what we're trying to do.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, by not reporting on Berkeley, but by letting Berkeley report on itself. And which, what does that mean? That means the people. It means when there's a hole. And believe me, we're nothing but holes now in terms of things that we don't cover, okay?
I would say you're going to amplify then, if that's what you mean, is give people the microphone. Isn't that amplifying?
I don't know. I mean, ultimately, isn't that what a news report is? You know, when a reporter does his or her job.
No, it's not just amplifying what the sources say, no.
Well, of course not, but that's where we get into trouble, I think, is anything beyond that.
That's why mirroring is not a good metaphor for news. It's much more of an act of construction.
Well, you see, this may be where we have a fundamental difference, because what?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You go east, I go west.
What's that?
I said maybe it's you go east, I go west.
Oh, come on. Let's not do that yet. I mean, differences are where it gets interesting.
Yeah.
I mean,
totally.
See, my problem, I've characterized the news report, the process, as reporter talks to N sources, 15 sources, right? Takes down the things that they remember, that they think are memorable. And that's being charitable, because oftentimes it's the things that are most embarrassing are the ones that they write down. And then string them together into the story that they want to create. Maybe not the story they wanted to create in the first place. They may not have known up front what they wanted to create.
Mm-hmm.
But in somewhere in the process of doing the story, they determine what the story is,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they string the quotes together, and you end up, if you're quoted in the piece, saying something or supporting something or being a piece of a narrative you find appalling,
mm-hmm.
horribly simplistic, totally
mm-hmm.
wrong,
mm-hmm.
harmful, all those things happen
mm-hmm.
over and over and over again. Where's the value in that?
Well, if that's all news was, Dave, it would be a consistent series of one fraud after another.
Okay. Well, that's I'm not far from saying that.
All right, well, that's your view of news.
No,
what it is,
I mean,
now, that, you know, I don't get it. That's all news is? No. Here's where I agree with you. The accounts we get are woven. They are constructed of the words of others. And there is a point reached very early in the way that a news story is put together where the source, the person speaking, has their words lifted out of whatever context they were providing and moved over into the production space of journalism, where it is very accurate to say that it is the reporter making the source speak, even though it is the source's words. And to that extent, I'm with you on your description. That is very true, and I've certainly noticed it myself, and lots of people have noticed that they lose control of their voice to the account. And that is the way those accounts are put together, for sure. Now, what good journalists do is, part of what you said, is they have a call list. They literally make a call list. These are the people I have to talk to for this story. Before they even make that list, they've done a ton of reading around what just happened. They're also bringing, if they're a beat reporter, a good reporter, all the knowledge that they know from previous things like this. Let's say they know how the Federal Reserve Bank works. They bring in all that. They probably talk to one or two people who know something about it in their own newsroom, whether it's their editor or a colleague, before they thought of what questions they want to ask. And they plan out their day, and judging by the deadline at the end of the day, they figure out how many calls can I make for this story. And in the morning, they just start calling everybody, and most people are not there, so they leave messages. And they call everybody once, and then by the time they get through their first morning calls, the people are starting to call them back. And then it's just scrambling from like 12 o'clock all the way to 4 o'clock with as many people as you can talk to, and some of the people call you when you're talking to the other ones, and you can never get everybody on your list. And then around 4 o'clock, you take everything you learned from all of those calls, from all of the reading you did, from what your sources told you, what your editor did, and your background knowledge, and in an hour, you put it together into an account that runs at a certain time. And that's journalism. And it isn't the same as listening to the sources. It's synthetic. It's a construction. And unfortunately, the way this construction asks to be trusted often is through some sort of invalid claim to authority. And that's the end of objectivity. That's what Weinberger is saying. Transparency is the new objectivity, meaning where we're coming from is more likely to be trusted than...
Well, in that story, where does that come... Where is the... You've described the reporter... As the source of objectivity, that's the story you just told. Was
that
the reporter? Where is the transparency in all that?
I just described the practice to you, Dave. I said
right. That's
the practice.
And I'd like to point out that and I was mesmerized by the description. And I've certainly that's a point of view, okay? And points of view are all valid, right? I'm not invalidating it. But there are other points of view. There's all the people that he talked to or she talked to during that process.
Yeah.
And their points of view are valid as well.
Oh, totally.
And not just about the subject matter, but also about the process itself.
Yeah, totally.
Right. So what would be really interesting to me, and I'm going to offer to, let's do this. I would, let's find a story that you think is very well constructed, okay? Right? And it doesn't, and then let's try to find the people that were in that story and find out what they think about it. Okay? Also, let's get the reporter to tell us their story about how it was put together. In other words, what was the process like? You know, and let's not ask any leading questions. Let's just ask them to tell us what the process was like. You know, and I think it'll be revealing. I think it'll show something perhaps in addition to what you've just described. And maybe it'll be hard to come up with an example of something that really is first rate. Maybe it won't be. Maybe you see it every day. I don't see it every day.
No, I wasn't saying anything about first rate, Dave. I was just saying this is how a story
or
is together.
Standard rate.
I'm not telling you it's the truth. I didn't say it was first rate. I didn't say it was excellent. I said this is how reporters work.
No, I say don't focus in on that term. I'm going to give on that one, all right?
This is how they work. That would be fascinating to do.
How about exemplary, okay? Can we agree to exemplary, not first rate?
Okay, all right.
That's exemplary. Just illustrates the practice.
Let's dig
into it. Let's find out what the people actually say. I want to tell you something. I once was on stage at an industry tech conference, just an executive conference. So everybody in the room was either a CIO, CTO, CEO, some XO, okay? These were like, and I was on stage with Dan Gilmore, and we were having a debate about this. Pretty much the same.
Is this going to be another press coverage sucks story?
Maybe. Maybe it won't be. Maybe I'll be convinced. Maybe I will be turned around and all of a sudden I'll go, man, I've been missing this whole thing the whole time. I really practice at being open-minded, Jay. I really do.
All right.
I have mechanisms to factor out. You know, I have said I'm wrong so many times. It's what I revel in. I like having my myths.
All right, so what happened when you guys were...
I asked for a show of hands how many people have ever been quoted accurately in the press.
Uh-huh.
I know it was just not one fucking hand went up. I mean, now I know that's a little bit... the place broke out in laughter, but nobody stood up to defend the press. They're just not happy.
Well,
I
can imagine that.
Can you? I mean, yeah. it's so... Anyway... I would love to get to the bottom of this one. I once boasted that I could... Never mind.
4 minutes for a source of inspiration.
It's
you
not
going
to take that long. Hopefully, I will overcome my last choice. And I think there is an obvious choice this week for inspiration on rebooting the news, and that would be Walter Cronkite.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And... How to begin this? Well, I mean, I put on my blog, scripting.com, this morning, the one excerpt from Walter Cronkite's career, and it's not the only one, but it's the one that he's most famous for, of him stepping out of the role that he defined so completely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and you could probably explain better than I all of the aspects. I mean, this is the reporter as God, right? I mean, as father figure, as Pope, as, you know, Ayatollah, as everything we have. This is the man. And, of course, a lot of the younger people right now don't understand. Somebody said that, you know, telling somebody who was born in 1984 about, you know, Walter Cronkite is like telling somebody our age about Charles Lindbergh, right? It doesn't really mean much to them. But
very true. Yeah.
Right.
Howard Kurtz said that, in fact, about his own staff. Howard Kurtz said that the staff...
That was Howard Kurtz, right.
Yeah. Didn't really have appreciation.
I'm reluctant to quote Howard Kurtz, but there you go. I did it. Not one of my favorite people. But, that was Howard Kurtz. You're right. And but it was a good quote. And so Cronkite was all of that, but... He did come down from that every once in a while, and we found a human being in there. And one of the classic examples of that is when JFK died, and he gets emotional, and you know, of course, that captures the moment for everybody. I don't specifically remember that one. I do remember him. What was it called? Hold on. I have to do this quickly because we're running out of time. The Cosmic Disaster editorial, where he gets on and he says, basically, Vietnam's a lost cause. We can't win it. We need to do what great countries do when they can't win, and we need to find a peace here. And this was seen by many, including the president, Lyndon Johnson, as the turning point in public opinion for the war in Vietnam. And it was the kind of leadership. He became much more than a spokesperson, a newscaster, an anchor, all the rest of that. But I think that it's a hat tip to the old system of news and the passing of Walter Cronkite to say that if there was ever any doubt that we're moving on, note that there has been no replacement for Walter Cronkite. There is no 2009 equivalent of Walter Cronkite for the moon landings, for the JFK assassination. We're
right. We're
on our own now, so that's my choice, Walter Cronkite. And that's rebooting the news.
That is fully appropriate, Dave.
Thanks, Jay. We look forward to talking again next week.
My pleasure. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.